Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler, and current writer and producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, formerly of New Scotland Yard, and founder and director of Paladin, National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And Lisa Zambetti, I'm the casting director for Criminal Minds and Beyond Borders, and I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes and the families affected by those crimes.
So we're back again with another installment of our discussion about the Colonial Parkway murders. And with us is Bill Thomas, the brother of Kathleen Thomas, who was murdered on October 12th, 1986. Thank you for coming back, Bill.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
I want to talk a little bit about the actual circumstances, sort of a crime scene reconstruction, if you will, about the actual homicides. To me, it's a significant point whether someone, if they are strangling someone or slitting their throat, whether that is done from the front or the back of the person, the victim. It seems to me that if they were being strangled from behind, that it would be very difficult to have left a piece of rope behind your sister's neck. In other words, you could either do it by holding a piece of rope in both hands and pulling and crossing it behind the neck, or wrapping a rope around with a slip knot and putting pressure from behind. But I don't know how that would result in a piece of rope being left behind your sister's neck if somebody then from behind slit her throat from beyond ear to ear. It seems to me that if the person was behind her when they slit her throat and that piece of rope was still behind her neck, they would have seen that and taken it with them because they took the rest of the rope, right?
They did. I agree with what you're saying, Jim. All I can tell you is my sister was wearing her hair a little bit longer then, and so it, you know, extended kind of down, you know, well past her neck. I don't know if they might not have seen it.
But what I'm saying is if they were actually holding that rope with one hand, let's say, and slitting throat from behind, if they were behind and holding that rope around her neck and then slitting her throat from behind, the part of rope that was in their hand would have been the part behind her neck. It seems to me that they would have had to have been in front of her, and the rope was around her neck, and they must have been applying the pressure from the front, and then slitting her throat, cutting two ends of that rope and leaving a piece behind her neck. I don't think that could be accomplished from behind her neck.
No, I'm not disagreeing with you. I mean, one of the things that I've always had the sense that they were likely unconscious after being strangled. In other words, whether they were, you know, whether they'd actually died at that point or not.
Well,
they might not have been conscious or moving.
One of the things that we have learned in our investigations is that when somebody dies from when blood is cut off to the head and the brain, it can cause brain death after a certain amount of time. The heart, although the person could be brain dead at the time, the heart can still beat. It has its own electrical impulse.
Right.
And it can continue to beat after brain death. So it's possible that somebody was brain dead and unconscious and yet still had the heart pumping after brain death for a certain number of minutes. But what I'm saying is just physically, if the person cut her throat from behind and this rope was still around her throat, then it's possible that they would have seen the rope that was there, that piece of rope that was left there.
Yes, I've been told by the FBI that it was badly blood-soaked, so I don't know if that might have obscured things, and it sure does sound like things had gotten, you know, very messy by that point. I agree. I think it's an odd little detail that this piece of rope was still there.
Yeah, but all it does is, to me, it tells me that there's a probability, and I think a high probability, that her throat could have been slit from the front, and she could have been strangled from the front rather than behind. And it's just the way that that it ended up that gives me that impression. And I can't tell you, I can't articulate every single detail of why, but I believe that if this rope was still attached to her, it was stuck to her, then I think she would have had to have been facing the offender when the rope was cut. Otherwise, I just would see that the rope would either fall off immediately or that they would have been aware of that piece of rope being there, that they were leaving a piece of forensic evidence behind that they didn't intend to. I mean, that's just my assessment of it. I don't know if you feel different, Laura.
Well, I'm just thinking, you know, it may not have fallen off. It depends what angle she was at and whether it was, you know, embedded. I mean, with hair, you know, et cetera, keeping things in place. And if she's at a certain angle, it may have just remained there. But I think certainly the throat, the way the throat was cut, I mean, to me, it signals silencing someone forever, particularly if she's already been strangled and asphyxiated to the point that, you know, she's not conscious. It's something that it sounds like was needed over and above what was truly required, particularly if this person had full control of both of them at that point. You know, it's the same with Nicole, where I have seen it, you know, in the case of Jane Clough, who was an A&E nurse, where she was stabbed multiple times, but he actually went back when he saw she was still alive and slit her throat in a similar way to silence her forever. And, you know, it's quite unusual, isn't it, Jim, to have those characteristics, you know, and with two females, you know, who are in a lesbian relationship together. You know, it's very unusual when you put all of these things together. But it certainly does, to me, talk about, you know, sort of hatred, rage and punishment.
Yeah, some of the profilers have also said to me that they thought there might be some significance. Again, I'm not saying this is my opinion. I'm just reflecting what they've said. That putting Kathy's body in the trunk, if you will, in the hatch, that was somehow more disrespectful than leaving Becky's body, you know, sort of on the diagonal across the back seat. That may have actually had some significance to the killer. To me, just the logistics of folding up someone who was, you know, that tall and her legs were long, and it seems like a significant effort to put someone in that position. Again, if two people were moving cars and that sort of thing, maybe this has more to do with the logistics of moving the Honda and perhaps using another vehicle. You know, it could be something
right.
as simple as that.
I mean, it's
that.
Effort and it's time spent too,
mm-hmm.
because the longer this person is at that scene, you know, although it may be quite remote and isolated, but there's still a chance that someone happens upon. So
sure.
Even the kind of the tidying up of putting them in a car,
right.
of taking that time and spending that time, you know, it certainly feels much more directed at Kathy, all of these things considered, and without the sexual assault, with them being fully clothed and there being no sign of a robbery, which tells us about, you know, the selection primarily probably towards, you know, Kathy. But certainly the hatred and rage much more directed towards her. Whether, you know, it's just a logistical thing of putting them both back in the car, and actually it's not really thought through who goes where, but it's about getting away at that point, because we don't know whether anybody else is heard in that particular area at that time. You know, this would take a little bit of time to do. This isn't a quick contact crime that, you know, is over within minutes. This is somebody spending time here, as well as, you know, pouring the whatever the substance was on top of them, pushing the car over.
Yeah, you know, no, I agree. This is time. It's
a lot
time consuming,
going on here.
And it's possible that the next person coming along that darkened parkway could be a Park Service Ranger or on
right.
patrol.
But also, just thinking of crime scene reconstruction, in my mind, it could be that this car. That this offender or offenders parked their car near where this car was, your sister's car was disposed of, and hiked back to the place where they were actually parking, and then drove, stuffed them in the car in the place they did, and then drove the car to that point and pushed it down the hill. You know, it's also possible that this person drove up behind them, pulled them off the road or came upon them in this lover's lane area, pulled up behind them, and had his car or her car right there with them and then pushed it down. I mean, those are both reasonable possibilities.
Yes.
And I think that we have to look at the other crimes and the other crime scenes to see how that played out and to see whether or not we think they're related and whether or not that gives us a better indication. Because in serial cases, I always say that the offender picks a particular victim at a particular time, in a particular place, in a particular manner for a particular purpose. And all those choices reflect back on that offender and why they did it. It reveals something about them unwittingly.
Now, so, Jim, see, I'm going to ask you a question because I noticed just then you said his or her car in terms of the offender.
Yeah. Well, I didn't want to – I don't usually like to make, you know, specific statements about that. But it is possible in this particular case, because your sister was in a lesbian relationship, it is possible that the offender could have been a female, could have been a jealous female.
That's correct. And that is something that they did look at. I think it's actually healthy, particularly when you're talking about two women that are involved in a romantic relationship, that you can't rule out the idea that another woman could have committed this crime. And I certainly don't want to be the guy that's falling back on sexual stereotyping, saying, oh, a woman couldn't have done this. I have a hard time picturing anyone doing it, male or female.
But if we're going with the theme of this being Kathy, who received the most dramatic and, you know, horrific injuries, the fact that she had what looks like defensive wounds, it could be that it's somebody that directed that anger and rage at her. And certainly if there are, I would look at suspects who would be male or female who might have some reason to be angry at her.
And of course, if we were thinking, you know, you're muting female, but if we were thinking female, then of course that would probably change the dynamic. And certainly in terms of weapons, you know, to control two females who are physically quite fit, it would probably talk more towards, you know, a gun being used as well.
Mm-hmm.
Not exclusively, but you always have to keep an open mind in these things.
Right.
If there were a sexual motivation, then we'd be going down much more the path if this was a sexually motivated crime on two females of a male offender.
Right.
And that's not being sexist or having a stereotype. It's just what we know about sexually motivated crime, not exclusively or exhaustively, but to carry this out in this way, if there were sexual violence. But obviously that is absent. So
right,
that's an important thing to acknowledge.
So I think where we are at, when we're looking solely at your sister's murder and Rebecca's murder, that there is a possibility that this was committed by a male offender or female offender. I just don't see enough to tell me that it's multiple offenders. I could be wrong, but I think it's probably a single offender who was very goal-directed, who may have had a direct reason to have anger and rage towards your sister, and or somebody who believed that who your sister represented was somebody that they have anger and rage towards.
I think that's pretty fair.
And we certainly can't rule out stalking, you know, prior selection stalking, and that's something else that we have to keep in mind when thinking about this case, how it relates to the others. I mean, in terms of, you know, preparatory sort of behavior and victim selection, whether it's somebody who knows her previously and, you know, as Jim mentioned, sort of some grudge-related behavior, which, you know, that for me is a strong probability, actually, in this case. But I think we need to look more in more detail at the other cases too. And certainly, for me, the case of the other two females who were murdered 10 years later.
Well, this sounds like a good time to take a break to hear a word from our sponsors. And now we're back from the break and back into the case.
So I have a question. Is it a situation where they were run? Like, what makes that car stop? What makes that murder happen where it is? I mean, my question is it something that if somebody knew her, were they following her in the car and waiting for an opportunity?
Did the two other women that they were working with know that they were in a relationship together?
Yes, absolutely. They had been introduced by my sister's first girlfriend, who was one of the four people that were together. And they said that Kathy and Becky were in the habit of going to the same spot every week along the Colonial Parkway. They didn't know where the spot was, but they knew that they went to the same spot, you know, to pull over listen to music and be romantic. And that probably after dinner that they may have gone to their favorite spot.
Yeah. So, I mean, to me, that's the highest probability that they intentionally went to a place. It's not just coincidental that they ended up in a lover's lane. They went there for the purpose of taking advantage of the privacy in a lover's lane.
Right.
Sure. I guess what I'm thinking is, if somebody knew her and wanted to kill your sister, you know, why not kill her at home? Or why, you know what I mean? Like, like, why this place as opposed to somebody who's laying in wait for somebody that they want to kill? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, as something that Laura had said, you know, when we take a look at four Lover's Lane situations together, so you can end up going down a road, and I'll defer to the professionals at the table, of thinking that perhaps this is, these crimes might be committed by someone who, you know, haunts, if you will, these kind of places where couples would go.
Stalks.
A better
word to use.
That's a better word. And would attack these people, perhaps more or less at random, versus someone that might know Kathy or Becky or both of them and have a grudge. You know, whether it's a jealousy. There's a lot of different motivations, of course. So, I don't know. In other words, there'd be other opportunities, I guess. The one thing about the Colonial Parkway, as I understand it, is it is a pretty isolated place at night and pretty quiet, and you're not likely to be interrupted. I do want to be clear here, though, that as I understand where the crime took place, it's not that far off the surface of the roadway. So in other words, that what we were talking about a minute ago about the idea that someone might come along in a car who could be a National Park Service ranger or could be just a passerby, they would probably, if the crime took place fairly close to where the car was found, that would probably be visible from the surface of the parkway. So there's some risky behavior going on here.
Were there any other precursor offenses there at all? I mean, normally we tend to see sort of some precursory sort of behaviors, other people being approached, or was there anything that...
Well, you know, some of this gets mixed in almost with urban legend. Laura, it's kind of frustrating, but there were a number of reports of people being pulled over on the parkway, and again, it's a little hard to tell, particularly with the passage of time, whether people are talking about before or after the Parkway murders. But there were reports that some people had been pulled over by people purporting to be police officers who might not necessarily have been. As a matter of fact, it's in the press back then, they actually asked people along the parkway to not pull over until they drove to a populated location, people remember the local law enforcement instructing them, if you're concerned, which I know we do now, but this was much less prevalent then, don't pull over on that lonely stretch of road. Drive to a place where there, you know, are people before you pull over.
Yeah, and you may not be aware of this, but Laura and I were talking about this as well, that there was Highway 29 murderer who it's more northern Virginia,
it was called the Highway 29 Stalker, wasn't
it? The Route 29 Stalker.
Right.
And I remember, because one of the women that was almost pulled over by this person, or attempted to be pulled over, was the wife of an FBI agent, and she had been instructed by her husband not to pull over if anything happened, and she didn't, and eventually the car stopped. They put on a flashing light to make it look like they were in Virginia. Those are blue flashing lights, and tried to get her to pull over. She did not pull over, and eventually the car pulled away. But at least one woman was killed on that stretch of road, and they believe it was under the same circumstances. So that's not too far away from here. Obviously, it's a ruse that can be very effective. But why would you do this out in the middle of nowhere? Because you're much less likely to get caught. Where was your sister living at the time?
She was living in Virginia Beach.
But where was she living?
An apartment.
With other apartments around
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
And her girlfriend was at school, was right?
It, actually living in a dorm at right. William & Mary.
So that's why you would do it there.
And this, by the way, one of the reasons why they went to this place was because it was about a 45-minute drive each way over to Kathy's apartment at William & Mary. So maybe on the weekend they might have gone over there. But it was an awfully long way to go on a Thursday night. And then, remember, Becky had to be back the next day at William & Mary on campus to attend this class. So we're talking about an hour and a half round trip. It's a long way to go. And at the same time, and you know, talking to Kathy and Becky's friends again recently, you know, they reminded me they didn't necessarily want to be seen on campus together all that much. Again, it's 1986. It's Virginia. It's William & Mary. Being a lesbian couple is not something that was particularly common. So this idea of them going to this place to be alone, it begins to make perfect sense. Because people have said to me recently, well, your sister's 27 years old, and, you know, she owned a house, and then she had her own apartment, and, you know, why is she behaving like a teenager? Well, I think something about an hour and a half round trip. And it isn't necessarily that they were involved in, you know, the throes of passion. They might have just gone to talk and kiss and listen to music. Young people are going to do what young people are going
to
do.
They may have gotten food and
something to eat, and then headed over there.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, I mean, and they weren't necessarily acting like teenagers. I mean, but, you know, Rebecca was 21. She's a college student, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so they were acting like college students, and one of them was. So I don't think that's, you know, a far stretch. But the point is that there was a very high likelihood, especially given the information from their friends, that this was deliberately where they stopped, or some place along this highway is where they stopped on a regular basis. And it's possible that because the person could have been stalking them, that they knew where they would be going and could lay in wait there. Or it's also possible that somebody sort of laid a trap and they fell into it. We don't know. But we will know more as we look at these other cases and compare and contrast. Mm-hmm. Things that stand out to us will no doubt give us some you know, confidence in one of those scenarios or another.
Just one last question about the car. So if they're parked there and it's at night, you can't necessarily see who is in the car. You don't know if it's two women, a man and a woman, or whatnot. Is that correct?
I would say so. And some people have said to me, you know, again, people toss out ideas that, you know, someone might have been, if it was a peeping Tom kind of situation, that they might have been outraged that two women were, you know, kissing or whatever, as opposed to a man and a woman. But yeah, you probably would not have been able to tell.
Well,
unless you got up close.
Or, like you just said, they could have been stopped and listening to music, making out. And if the music is on, it's possible that the radio light is on or the interior lights are on. I mean, if the car is going, you know, so they may have been able to see more than you think. And, you know, we can't make assumptions about that one way or the other because we don't have the car. We don't have the crime scene photos.
Right.
We don't know what the condition of it was.
But if there's music on, then maybe you don't hear an approach. Yeah. You know, you're kind of into the thing that's going on inside the car and you don't hear an approach.
Yeah.
I mean, you do, and it shocks you and puts you into sort of surprise mode
on the back foot from the start. I recall FBI telling us they were looking at people that, you know, had been involved in peeping Tom incidents or, you know, creeper kind of things, you know. And obviously there are people that will go to lovers' lane situations.
The stalking element.
Well, those are the precursor crimes that Laura was mentioning, that those are the kinds of things that we'll see leading up to this. If this was this killer's actual first kill, then those are the kinds of things that we typically see leading up to it. If it is that kind of a, you know, sort of set your trap and wait for a victim to fall into
it. It's more about the location and the geography than it is about them specifically as people.
Right. Right.
Or Kathy in particular.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so many variables. Oh, my God.
Well, one interesting variable here is that of the four couples, Kathy and Becky are the only one. Ironically, they're the lesbian couple, but they're the only ones that are actually in any kind of serious relationship. David Nobling and Robin Edwards met that day. So it's at best an assignation. In other words, they've never been on a date before.
It's at best a sexual assault of a child.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's
a
crime.
Yes.
If that's what they were doing. It wasn't just
she's just 14.
She's
14
years old.
We haven't even talked about that yet, but something.
But another reason why somebody who might be morally indignant at that might have decided to kill them. So,
what's that? We use that word on the show. I know it's fiction, but we use a word for somebody who is like not a corrector.
A moral enforcer?
A moral enforcer. That's.
I could make a case that all four of these couples are engaged in sin, if you will. There's a man that was put to death shortly before the Colonial Parkway murders kicked off named Michael Marnell Smith, who was involved with a very conservative, some people called it a cult, church located on the Colonial Parkway. If Michael Marnell Smith had not been put to death by the Commonwealth of Virginia just 2 months before Kathy and Becky died, I'm sure law enforcement would have taken a hard look at this guy.
What's his name? Michael?
Michael Marnell Smith. And Mr. Smith was convicted of raping one woman and then later raping and killing another woman, ironically, also with William and Mary ties. And this man went out and he struck out at those women because, you know, in one example, she was sunbathing alongside the river, and he was, in his twisted mind, he was offended by this. Now, if Smith hadn't been put to death, I would say a guy like Michael Marnell Smith would be, you know, the kind of moral enforcer, as Jim said. All of these couples are involved in some level of romantic or sexual activity, you know, kind of out in the open. Some of it might be a little bit of a stretch. Cassandra Haley and Keith Call are also on a first date. He had just broken up with his girlfriend, a very serious girlfriend he'd gone to high school with. He and Cassandra were on a first date. People who were at the party that night, whom I've spoken to, told me they didn't seem particularly interested in each other. They kind of spent the evening at the party with other college students talking to other people. However, they did leave together at the end of the night, and it's possible maybe they did go to get to know each other better. But Keith's car is the one that's found along the Colonial Parkway. And, I've talked to the FBI recently about the Phelps-Lauer case. They're the couple that are found on I-64, and I had said something to the investigator about the fact that they weren't a couple, and the investigator hesitated and said, well, we think there may have been something going on there of a sexual nature. Mm-hmm. And in several of these examples, there's clothing found in the car. In the back to the Call Haley example, where his Toyota Celica is found along the Colonial Parkway, there's a substantial number of articles of clothing found in the car. It was a cool evening in April. There was some theory that perhaps they went skinny dipping, but on a rainy, kind of misty night in April when the water temperature was in the 40s, I don't think so. But they might have been fooling around, or they might have been, have been forced to disrobe.
Right. But, I mean, you mentioned Michael Marnell Smith, and you said he was put to death a couple of months before. Well, somebody might have been pissed off that he was put to death.
Well,
for enforcing morals, and they might have
picked
just
up where he left.
Yeah. Well, without pointing fingers, Michael Marnell Smith is from a family of 12. His family live on the Colonial Parkway, and again, I'm not accusing anyone of anything, but they came from an extremely conservative, some people said cult, church, which still exists today, and you know, it's cross, again, when you have 150 plus persons of interest, different thoughts cross your mind as different names come forward. Certainly, if somebody else was following the kind of mental path that Mr. Smith was on, you know, could a brother or a nephew or someone like that.
Or another churchgoer.
Sure.
Yeah.
But, you know, here's a family that actually owned the land that the Colonial Parkway runs through, who obviously have been there for many, many years, and they have a very strong attachment. And, you know, based on what I've read about Mr. Smith, he did not approve of what was happening along the Colonial Parkway, and that's why he lashed out.
Right. Well, and that may or may not have anything to do with these cases.
So this seems like a good time to take a break. So here's a word from our sponsors. So now we're back and we're continuing our conversation.
Sorry that we're rehashing all these very painful memories, I'm sure, for you. And I know it was difficult for you to travel back in Virginia and actually visit the site where your sister's body was found. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, it wasn't all downbeat because I did have an opportunity to meet a lot of great people, many of whom I had this, you know, internet and sort of web-based relationship with, phone and, you know, Skype and Google Hangouts. And it's so much more meaningful to meet people in person. They were also wonderfully supportive. And I learned a lot from going to the four sites and understanding a lot more about kind of the lay of the land there in Williamsburg this past week.
And you mentioned before to us that there were some new things that you learned that actually you realized that some things that were in your head weren't quite factually accurate. Can you just tell us a bit about that?
I had thought of these four crime scenes, two on the Colonial Parkway, and then one at Ragged Island, and then one on I-64 up in New Kent County, as being really far away. But when I actually, you know, fired up those addresses and put them in my GPS, I was in both those locations in a half an hour in either direction. They're not like right next door, but they're not very far away. And if you think about these crimes taking place for the most part late at night when traffic is light, really not that far away.
Right. I mean, that's why going to the scene just tells you so much more. But certainly, you know, offenders do travel too. So where they may start out offending and they may start to move their geographic sort of spread, if you like, and it depends whether they're going after a particular type of victim or whether it's the geography. So actually, that's very helpful to know.
It's incredibly valuable to go to the place and stand there and walk around and think about what transpired there and what happened at that location at that time. Now,
and best at the time that it occurred. So whether it's, you know, in the summer or whether it's in winter, but actually at the time, you know, in terms of to the hour, whether it's at night, whether it's early in the morning,
mm-hmm.
That tells you an awful lot. It's the same concept of going to buy a house. You know, when you walk in, you want to go and see it, but you want to go there at different times throughout the day and the night. So you get a sense of how loud is the road noise, how loud are the neighbors, what's going on in the streets. It's the same sort of idea.
Yeah, I remember my younger brother renting an apartment in New York City, and the first time he was there at night, he discovered that his block was occupied by ladies of the evening, which hadn't occurred to him until he got there. You know, he already had put the deposit down too late.
Too late. So those kind of decision-making, you know, and what's going on at the time, is it a busy place? Is it a quiet place?
Right.
What kind of noises, you know, are you likely? And you said it when you talked about Kathy, you know, just how close that was to the road,
mm-hmm.
you know, and how you can really hear vehicles.
Right.
You know, and these kinds of things, because it tells us, were they likely, you know, where they parked up there? Jim asked the question, was there somewhere else that was much more secluded that
right.
actually would have afforded them more privacy for them to go?
Right.
The nuanced details.
So, for example, the two Colonial Parkway sites, first takeaway, as soon as I got there, I said, killings didn't take place here. It's just too close to the road, too exposed. There's just the off chance that someone may come along. In the other two examples, in New Kent County, it's way out in the country. It's close to a major highway, but it's very quiet. And the same thing with the Ragged Island Wildlife Preserve. It's right next to this major bridge. But then I realized when you get to the actual place, it's in the open, but it's secluded because of the kind of almost the shadow of the bridge. so that no one could see what you were doing. And if it was right. at night, you know, even though you might feel like you're kind of out there under the stars and there's a major structure nearby, you'd have total privacy.
Right.
And Bill, had any... I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, and what else was new to you in terms of what you held in your head about what you thought, and what were some of the new bits of information that actually challenged that or made you think differently?
Well, one of the things I realized is that we've got people with different objectives. In other words, we have couples, young people being young, going out, and they're out, and their goal is privacy, to be romantic or to be sexual or what have you. And then I think someone else comes along who has a much more dark goal, and it feels like these were places that these young people went to be alone, and then someone else shows up who obviously has a much more kind of malevolent agenda. But I realized just how much these would be places that could be beautiful and romantic and kind of private, and then it feels like someone else shows up who then obviously changes the chemistry of what's happening in a very terrible way. And I hadn't really quite grasped that these would be places that a couple would go to, to be, romantic, and that part was sort of a kind of a mental adjustment for me.
Right. And would you just happen upon these places?
I don't think you would. I think you'd have to know your way around. You'd have to know your way around. There is something odd about the Colonial Parkway. I said that it's very limited access. It's even more so than a highway. In other words, on a highway in the U.S., you get on and you get off, and there are these exits. With the Colonial Parkway, it's kind of this, it's often quite narrow. In other words, it's hemmed in by the river, and there are these fences for these military installations that are quite close by. And so the National Park Service built the parkway, and it sometimes gets quite narrow, only a few hundred yards, and then other times it expands out. But something that did occur to me, it's kind of this narrow chute, and there's a very limited number of ways to get on and off the parkway unless you have a key to these gates, which, park rangers and folks like that would have. But everybody else, it's kind of odd. You get into this chute, and then you really have a very limited number of ways out. So it actually occurred to me, I don't want to be overly dramatic, but I actually had the thought, it's a little bit like a killing ground. In other words, you're kind of fenced
in.
You're trapped. There'll be a fence somewhere back in the woods and I'm talking about, 6 feet tall, and then the river or something like that, or a marsh on the other side. And it occurred to me, once you're in, you kind of can't get out until you go a couple of miles, 3-4 miles. Down the road to the next exit. And then there might be another one, but it might be a couple of miles more, that was very striking to me.
So points to local knowledge.
It does. I think you'd have to know your way around, and you'd have to know where to look and where these young people were going to be alone.
I mean, local knowledge, or, if you're drawn in by the victim, as in you're following them because you're targeting them, then it's high risk in another way. If you're going to be boxed in, or you're going to go to an area that you know nothing about, and you're going to, you have a plan in your head of what you're going to do, but it's a risky location in some senses.
Well, and I use this kind of very similar language. I said to one of my guides when we were at one of the sites, the Ragged Island site, I said, there's only one way out. And they said, exactly. And I said, this is really risky. I'm talking about for the killer now. In other words, a killer has to, I think about, how do I get away? There's only one way out of this place. And I said to my guide, this is really, really risky. And they said, exactly. That's the point. They may enjoy that this isn't a place like on a city block. You could go a dozen different ways and move away from a crime scene quickly. This is one of those situations where if you were on foot or in a car, unless you had a boat, which I think is extremely unlikely, like in the Ragged Island example, if you were down this road, which is maybe 50 feet wide with fences on either side, and I'm told it had fences back then too, because I was always asking, well, what was it like back then? You know, that sort of thing. Like, in other words, am I looking at it here in August 2016? Is it the same basic layout as it was back then? In some cases it's changed, but in many cases it had not. But when we got down to the place where they think that the killings took place, I said, there's no way out of here for the victims. But at the same time, I think the killer has to at least be thinking, killer or killers have to be thinking, how do I get out of here if the good guys show up?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the cops, I mean, that's all part of offender decision making that we take into account of what would, you know, be their most obvious decision. So it could be very risky, or they're very confident. You know, they're very confident about the execution of what they are going to do.
Yeah. And, you know, don't totally discount the thought of a boat, because you said that people are over there fishing and so forth. Mm-hmm. And obviously it's a major waterway. The Chesapeake Bay breaks off into the York and the James Rivers. So, I mean, there's hundreds of thousands of boats that have access to that area. So people live on boats. People spend a lot of time. And certainly...
Would it arouse suspicion, you know, a boat?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, in one of the reports that I did this week, this was for television. And of course, you know, they're doing the video thing. And I was just answering the questions and I was focused on that. And they said, oh, we got this beautiful shot, Bill, when you were talking, you know, a fishing boat went behind you. So Jim's right. There are boats everywhere. So I can't rule it out. But I was very struck when we got down to this kind of beach area that was hundreds of yards away from where the car was found. And we walked there. It was like a chute. That was the word that came to mind. It was like a narrow, kind of almost a pen-like
feel. Then any offender would know that that's the only direction that they had to worry about being disturbed from.
You're absolutely correct.
And we also have to think, you know, we call it hiding in plain sight, or, you know, part of the street furniture, or in this case, river furniture. Mm-hmm. The things that you're just used to seeing commonly actually do not arouse suspicion. And of course, you can get easy entry in without being noticed and exit without being noticed.
Right, right.
No headlights, no car tires, no noise.
Mm-hmm. It's just part of the routine. Doesn't arouse.
People, you know, look at this lovely picturesque fishing boat going by. You know, it just doesn't arouse suspicions. It's just what you would expect on a river.
Yeah, absolutely. One other thing, too, you know, the meeting with the FBI, I spent 5 hours with them one day and 4 hours 2 days later, which was, you know, amazing. And they answered a lot of questions. I can't get into all the details here, but...
So the two separate days you met with them.
Two separate days I met with them. And it was really super helpful from my perspective. And I was so impressed with the team, too. You know, every single person I met in that office, they were incredibly knowledgeable about the case. They knew who I was. They knew who Kathy was. You know, so that felt really good. Also, talking to really smart people who have a great understanding of the case and have, you know, not everybody marches in lockstep. There's a lot of different ideas. Mm. And almost everything that the FBI experts said to me at the end of, you know, a segment when they were offering, you know, what their thoughts were about the case, they would say, but I could be wrong, even to the point where I would start to laugh. But the truth is, until you're able to sort this whole thing out, you know, some very, you know, well thought out, impassioned, committed people, you know, delivered different perspectives on what they think could have happened in the Colonial Parkway murders. But, you know, at the end of it, and you're like, wow, I'm convinced. But they would smile and say, but I could be wrong, because as you well know,
there are theories and hypotheses, and you have to test out those things. But I guess, well, I know, I mean, for you, it must be very reassuring to know that you have committed individuals who understand the detail of the case and who are committed to actually solving this after all these years, that it's no longer a frozen case.
Right.
I would say it was one step back from cold, and now you said it was very hot in Virginia, and I was hoping that the case has become a hot case too, which is what you want it to be investigatively.
And it felt good, and they walked us through where they were with, you know, moving different forensics tests forward and sending, you know, sending in lots of material from the case, which are held at the FBI field offices, into Quantico for testing. And they walked me through, you know, what our status was. Sometimes it's frustrating because cold cases are the lowest priority, which I understand. You know, nothing's going to bring back any of these eight young people. So, and as Jim has mentioned on these podcasts, we have threats to real life people, including, you know, America in general. So I haven't lost sight of that.
Yeah, but I disagree. This is a public protection issue. Whoever this person is presents a risk to other people.
I'm not saying that. I'm saying that there are priorities. And because after 9/11, the FBI pulled back significantly from criminal investigations. I mean,
we did cover this. I mean, we all agreed that resources have been taken away. What I'm making the point about is that whoever this killer is out there and has not been found. Yeah. So they are still a public protection risk, irrespective. You know, it's gone from being a frozen case to now being open. We don't know what this individual has done in between this.
Right.
Okay, and that's a very real point. We don't know what they did before this, but we don't know what they're doing now. They could be harming multiple people.
But it's obvious that there's a ton of more information for us to go through, and we're not going to be able to get through it all today. But we will have you back, Bill, again, to go through the details of the other murders that have been now known as Colonial Parkway murders, as well as the additional one in 1996 that Laura was talking about earlier. We really appreciate your time and all the details you're giving us, and we hope you'll come back so we can talk more about this case.
Thank you. I look forward to it.
Great.
Thank you, Bill. It's been, you know, incredible talking to you, and you're obviously, you know, you've lived through this, you've been in the shoes of, but you've also become almost like a pseudo-expert on the detail, you know, and the devil's always in the detail with these cases. So I certainly appreciate, as do the team, you talking us through it and sharing those details.
And I'm it's so important that you keep fighting the fight, that you just are tirelessly moving forward constantly trying to bring justice to not only your sister, but the rest of these victims.
Thank you.
We appreciate it, definitely. Well, thank you very much from those of us at Real Crime Profile. We'll be back again with Bill Thomas to talk more about this incredibly fascinating and disturbing case.
So if you like our show and you want to help us out, there are a couple things you can do. First, you can go over to iTunes and leave us a positive 5-star review. You can also like our Facebook page and join in on some great questions, comments, and conversations. We always love to hear from you there. You can follow us on Twitter. You can check out our sponsors. And most importantly, you can share us with friends, family, and anyone you know who's interested in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. Thanks for listening.
For advice or support, if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0207 840 8960 or go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter, safety or counselling, call the Genesis 24-hour hotline 214 946 4357 or go on the website www.genesisshelter.org or you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline on 800 799 7233.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan, engineered by Jacob Moose Molin. Music is composed and performed by Simba Sumba. Logo art by Rob Cohen. Real Crime Profile is produced and recorded at Empire Studios LA by XG Productions. Real Crime Profile is distributed by Wondery.